Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Service and Sports Illustrated Kids. I'm Dick Hayden. I'm filling in for your regular reader, John Ivey. Over the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Sports Illustrated Kids, sort of a collection of items from different issues, because there was a combined January-February edition put out, and we don't have a new one until next week. So, the content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm going to start off by picking back up on the article that we started last week and ran out of time on. We didn't really get all that far into it, so I'm going to go ahead and just start it from the beginning. That way you'll have the full focus on it. It's a Kid Reporter article by Mia Fishman. These trailblazers prove that football is a women's game, too. When she was in junior high, Amy Trask fell for football. "I just love the game," she says. "It's a game of matchups. Can my linebackers cover your running backs? Can my corners cover your receivers? How does my pass protection match up against your pass rush?" That was the 1970s. While attending law school in the 80s, she learned and interned with the Oakland Raiders and landed a full-time job as the team's legal department in 1987. 10 years later, she was named the chief executive officer. She was the first female front office executive in the NFL. By the time she left the organization in 2013, a lot had changed for women who wanted to work in football. What's really changed is the on-field foothold, whether in the training room, as an assistant trainer, or an assistant coach. "Maybe someone wants to be a scout," says Trask, who is now an NFL analyst for CBS. "That's where things have evolved more. When I started at the league and when I walked in on my first owners' meeting, I was the only woman there, other than those who were married to team owners or were part of the family. I was the only woman there who wasn't related to an owner. But over the course of the years, many more women joined the league. In 2015, the Arizona Cardinals hired Jennifer Weltler as coaching intern for training camp and the preseason. She was the first female position coach. Since then, four women have joined NFL coaching staffs, including Katie Sowers, a current offensive assistant with the San Francisco 49ers. "I've always known that I wanted to be a coach," says Sowers. "Women are now seeing more opportunities to work in the world of football, even have a professional league." Lisa King is the commissioner of the Women's Football Alliance, which is a competitive tackle football league for women. King founded the league in 2009 and has since seen tremendous progress for women in the world of football. The WFA has become the largest women's tackle football league in the world. King, who wants to bring top athletes together, has always fought for women to have a chance to play football at a professional level. "When I was growing up, women weren't playing football," she says. "Now, having the WFA, we are able to show girls that no matter what sport they want to play, there is an opportunity." Now, that's where we cut off last week, so let's continue on. Adds Sowers, "People always ask me if I think a woman will ever play in the NFL, and to me, that's not the goal. The goal is just like any other sport. We have separate leagues, and women's football exists. I hope light is shed on that, and the societal norms start to change. It wasn't too long ago that people thought about that women could not run marathons, and I think that's the way we will look back on football." The Women's Football Alliance has served as a platform for many influential women in the world of football. Mary Rose Roach, the founder of the Football Hers, Inc., played for the Philadelphia Liberty Bells and was not only a team captain, but also the 2010 WFA MVP. Linda Bache was the owner and general manager of the Chicago Force from 2005 until 17 and was the WFA Owner of the Year in 2013. Under Bache's ownership, Elizabeth Oakey played for the Chicago Force from 2009 to 14 and played in the WFA Championship game in 2013. Oki was invited to be on the board of directors of USA Football. Sowers played for the Kansas City Titans and won the WFA American Conference Offensive MVP Award in 2014. She started her career in the NFL in 2016 when she became a scouting intern for the Atlantic Falcons, as well as a wide receivers coaching intern. Kyle Shanahan, a former Falcons offensive coordinator, brought Sowers to San Francisco in 2017 as part of the Bill Walsh NFL Coaching Diversity Fellowship. Sowers says that her gender has not hindered her in her pursuit of a job in coaching. "The happiness and excitement I felt when I first got the job was mainly just me being excited about finding a career path that I felt suited me," she says. "Ever since I was little, I knew that football was a sport for me. Being a woman and being that leader of breaking barriers, that was an added bonus to me." Sowers loves her job. She feels she is treated by the same, exactly the same as any other coach, and she can't recall negative experiences with players. "I want to help them create the best possible versions of themselves on the field and off the field," she says of her goals for the players. "That's what coaching really is. I have the opportunity to work with so many great professionals because that's what they are." Both Sowers and Trask believe that their impact on the players is crucial to being successful. "The women with whom I've spoken around the league, whether they are working in football areas or in the business areas, have articulated the same thing. Players want to know that you're a good teammate," says Trask. "Over the years, women have begun to appear more frequently in higher positions, important roles, and on-field jobs. From the office to the sideline and to the field, women like Trask, Sowers, and King refuse to let anything get in the way of their passion for football and their careers." Trask has considered her career to not only be a path for her, but for other women as well. "If some young woman looked at me and said, 'Well, I can get into football too,' that's just terrific." Next up is an article by Abigail Dove, a kid reporter, and her titled article is "Toronto's John Tavares is Living His Childhood Dream." If you were a kid who grew up playing minor hockey in Toronto, chances are you grew up cheering for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Members of the Leafs Nation, as their fans are called, often have all-encompassing passion for the team that has been passed on from generation to generation. John Tavares was one of those kids. He dreamt of one day playing for the team that he loved. 5 months ago, when Tavares became a free agent, several teams lined up to try to sign him, including the Maple Leafs. On July 1, in one of the most significant signings in NFL history, Tavares agreed to a 7-year contract worth $77 million to play for Toronto. Now the 28-year-old is literally living his childhood dream. Tavares was a prodigy in his minor hockey days and was the first player to be granted exceptional status by the Canadian Hockey League. This meant he was allowed to play a year earlier than normal. The New York Islanders selected him first in the overall 2009 draft, and Tavares spent the first 9 seasons of his career there, the last 5 as their captain. As a child, Tavares loved watching the Leafs and looked up to everyone on the team. He had a white Maple Leafs jersey he would wear all the time. "I remember being really young and watching Doug Gilmore and Wendell Clark, and they were great Maple Leafs," says Tavares. "I dreamed of being like them and playing for the Maple Leafs. So it's kind of surreal now to think that the possibility came true. I'm doing something that I thought about and dreamed about since I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old." The numbers athletes wear are often important to them. And when it comes to the best in hockey histories, numbers such as 66, 87, 97, and 99 are familiar to even the most casual hockey fan. Players may have their favorite numbers, but that doesn't mean they always get to wear them. Growing up, Tavares wore number 19, but when he changed teams, he had to change to 91 that he wears today. "My best friend was playing for the Toronto Marlboros when I came to the team," Tavares said. He was wearing 19, and I wore 19 up until then, and he wanted to keep his number, so I said, that was good with me. There weren't too many guys wearing 91 at the time, so I flipped the 19 into a 91 and had a really good season. Ever since then, I have worn it. It's kind of funny, and we chuckle about it sometimes because it's amazing the way those things impact your life. The day he signed with Toronto this year would be another moment that would impact not only Tavares' life, but the Leafs nation as well. I felt very fortunate to be in the position I was in, where I had not just Toronto, but numerous teams that were interested, he says. To have that kind of interest at this level and this league is something you do not take for granted. I knew there was a lot of positive things happening in Toronto, and they certainly proved to me why this is an opportunity that I could not pass up. Once he signed, it was time for Tavares to move back to Toronto, but he didn't settle back in his old neighborhood, instead choosing to live closer to downtown. I wanted to be a little closer to Scotiabank Arena, our practice facility at the MasterCard Center, and the airport. I'm not right in the heart of the city, but it's a nice suburb where my wife and dog and I all live. Toronto is a vibrant, active city with many interesting things that do not relate to hockey. I think there are lots of good things to do, whether it's just going around town and taking our dog for a walk, trying a lot of great restaurants, enjoying some of the many great parts of the city, he says. I really enjoy Evergreen Brickworks quite a bit. I think it's a great market. He is also really enjoying the atmosphere Leafs Nation brings to home games. It's pretty cool. The buzz around town and how much people love the team. What the team means to the city, and not just as a sport, but as a way of life and the way it impacts people on a daily basis, he says. For Tavares, the draw of coming to Toronto was not solely based on realizing his childhood dream. It was largely based on the team's projected success on the ice, with the added bonus of playing in front of family and friends. The most important thing for me as I went through the process was focusing on having success on the ice and what would be best for my career and whether it was the right fit for me as a hockey player, he says. Tavares certainly had a special bond with his Islanders teammates over the 9 years he played there. Having to start fresh with new teammates is not always easy. But he's excited about the next phase of his career in Toronto. We have a great group of guys who are extremely committed to doing the best we can to represent the city and the team to get where we want to, he says. It's a learning process. But when you play on a line with guys like Zach Hyman and Mitch Marner, they're so talented. They make the game easier for me. They do so many good things that put me in a good position to succeed. I just try to be as great as I can be and to play my game and make plays for them. Tavares is a hero to many kids, much like Gilmore and Clark were to him. I feel very fortunate to be a role model and be something that kids aspire to, says Tavares. It's definitely pretty cool, and I try to be the best I can be and impact somebody positively. His advice for kids wanting to follow in his footsteps? Have fun. Fall in love with hockey, he says. It's a great game. And you develop so many friendships and meet so many people along the way. My closest friends are the guys that I have played with. John Tavares is now living his childhood dream, and the excitement in the Leafs Nation is the highest it's been in many years. He plays in front of his family and friends almost every night, just like when he was a kid. New York was a great city to live in, and my family and friends visited often. But certainly being here and having them around more is an added bonus, he says. I know how much effort and sacrifice my parents made to give me the opportunity to play hockey as a kid, to have his dream, to live it for real, and have this career. I am very thankful. Now we'll slip over to basketball and kid reporter Max Bonstetter. His article is titled Gonzaga, or Gonzaga, depending on your wishes, and USF have the WCC on the rise. Yes, Gonzaga came away with a 96-83 win at San Francisco earlier in the month, but the score does not begin to reflect how closely contested this matchup really was. The Dons actually led with less than 5 minutes remaining in the game, but the Zags finished well. West Coast NCAA basketball often doesn't get the respect it deserves, and this contest certainly exceeded the expectations. It showcased two talented, disciplined teams with seasoned leadership as the teams combined for a total of only 9 turnovers in the game and 11 players scored in double digits. Senior guards Josh Perkins and Frankie Ferrari not only expertly handled the ball for USF, but also turned in impressive offensive performances. In the end, Zags coach Mark Few summed up the contest the best when he stated, "I thought it was two teams really battling at a high level, both teams. We just ended up making a couple of more plays at the end." The results showed just how competitive the West Coast Conference is. After their narrow loss to the Zags, the Dons fell slightly in the NCAA net evaluation tool, and they now rank 37th. The net relies on game results, strength of schedule, game location, scoring margin, net offense and defensive efficiency, and the quality of wins and losses. The WCC has two teams in the top 55. The Zags is second, and St. Mary's is 55th. While the Pac-12 only has one, Washington, which is 32nd. The Dons rank ahead of 11 of the 12 teams from the Pac-12 conference. This is a major accomplishment for the Dons and WCC, especially in a year when St. Mary's and BYU are struggling. Many experts are now saying WCC is on the way to becoming a consistent top 10 conference, and others are suggesting that the WCC is now in the best conference in the West. While the WCC may have to develop strength from the top to bottom after watching this classic battle between the Zags and the Dons, it's clear that the top of the conference can compete with the elite conferences. The West Coast Conference should command at least 2 NCAA bids this season. If USF is able to win some games on the road in addition to their Stanford and Harvard wins and defend at home, they will have a compelling case for an at-large bid for the committee. Coach Kyle Smith knows his team has a lot of season ahead and will use this narrow loss as an opportunity to learn and to stay visible. Coach Smith is a firm believer in analytics. He pointed out that the integrity of their defense is the area most impacted by statistics and analytics. He said the Dons pride themselves on limiting good shots, although he felt the Dons did not execute exactly to plan against the Zags. The Zags found out early in this game that USF's defense is top-notch. The Dons disrupted the Zags' ability to execute its half-court sets, and a veteran point guard, Josh Perkins, was held scoreless in the first half. The Dons' home court, War Memorial Gym, has the same motion-tracking cameras that occupy all 30 NBA arenas. The technology allows teams to monitor every move a player makes, measure their stamina, and even grades the performance of the referees. This allows USF to have their own player efficiency rating, just like the NBA. Coach Smith calls it nerd ball, but it seems to be working as the Dons, despite working with a roster devoid of future NBA players, continues to gain traction in both the WCC and on the national level. His Dons had another crack with the Zags, and the rematch was on February 7 on the Zags' home court. We'll slip over to baseball now, and Kid reporter Anderson Picard tells us my experience at the 2018 MLB Winter Meetings. The 2018 Winter Meetings in Las Vegas were action-packed and full of surprises. The meetings officially started on Sunday, December 9th, as the PBEO job fair kicked off, with dozens of people looking for one of their first jobs in baseball. Although the event wasn't quite in full swing yet, there were still people hovering around and exploring. Besides the people at the start of the job fair and the few media members searching for strong Wi-Fi, there were not many people to be seen in the baseball portions of the Mandalay Bay Convention Center on that first day. More baseball executives and reporters arrived on Monday, as the ratio of people with the winter meeting credentials to those attending in the neighboring rodeo convention increased. For the reporters who filed into the media workroom at 9 in the morning, the event got off to a rocky start as they realized the brown containers of liquid were full of vegan hot cocoa rather than coffee. The unofficial kickoff of the meetings took place with a press conference with the Tampa Bay Rays manager Kevin Cash, who talked about several developments, including two well-respected members of his staff, Rocco Baldelli and Charlie Montoyo, taking jobs as managers elsewhere in the majors. He had lots of praise for them. Next, Philadelphia Phillies manager Gabe Kapler discussed the free agent class and the various off-season plans, as well as updating everyone on how his family was after the devastating fires in California destroyed his hometown. Miami Marlins manager Don Mattingly, Texas Rangers manager Chris Woodward, and Cincinnati Reds manager David Bell also spoke on Monday. Later, the Boston Red Sox introduced Nathan Eovaldi, after they finalized his four-year, $68 million contract. I asked him what he would have said if somebody told him back in June that he would be signing the biggest contract of his life with the Red Sox. I wouldn't have believed that at all, especially from where I was in June, not even a part of the Red Sox yet. I also asked if the new contract comes with added pressure, but he said that the size of the deal doesn't matter. I try not to put pressure on myself. The contract is what it is, and I have to go out there and perform well. But I feel like, with our group of guys, everybody takes the pressure away. In the afternoon, Harold Baines and Lee Smith were elected to the Hall of Fame. The event included a funny moment when Smith couldn't figure out the buttons on his Hall of Fame jersey, and a sad one, as Baines choked up talking about his father, who passed away before he could see his son become a Hall of Famer. I also spoke with Red Sox manager Alex Cora about what it was like to bring the World Series trophy back to Puerto Rico. He said it was a great feeling. We talked about Dustin Pedroia's status for 2019, which is becoming more clear, and could end up with the veteran second baseman playing opening day in Seattle. Right after speaking with Cora, I took a stroll with MLB's chief baseball officer and New York Yankees legend Joe Torre. Our conversation began with a focus on his opinion of designated hitters in the Hall of Fame. He said that with Harold Baines getting in, the door is open for guys like Edgar Martinez and David Ortiz. But we mainly discussed pace of play. A group of people were meeting Wednesday to discuss the topic, and he thinks the games are starting to get too long. He referenced that there were more strikeouts than hits in the 2018 season, something that can become slightly boring to even the biggest baseball fans. Tuesday featured more than a dozen managerial press conferences. The two most interesting conferences were those of the New York managers, Aaron Boone of the Yankees and Mickey Callaway of the Mets. Boone was brief, providing positive updates on injured catcher Gary Sanchez, while also rediscussing who will play where in the infield. Callaway talked a lot about the catching position, while joking with the media about JT Realmuto, and also discussing the Mets' outfield and farm system. There were just nine press conferences on Wednesday, including exciting ones from Braves manager Brian Snitker, Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire, and Angels manager Brad Asmus. Snitker discussed how Atlanta is exploring the idea of using an opener in 2019. Gardenhire discussed more about his farm system than the majors. However, news broke as the conference was wrapping up that the Tigers just signed shortstop Jordy Mercer. And although Gardenhire didn't comment on it, I was among many people who confirmed this piece of news, with a front office member from the Tigers standing nearby. Asmus was excited to see Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani both healthy for the 2019 season, and had nothing but praise for Ohtani, much to the delight of a group of Japanese reporters in attendance. I was fortunate enough to be able to head up to one of the top floors of the Delano Hotel to meet with Tigers general manager Al Avila and his large staff in his suite. We talked about several things, including the rebuild that the team is going through as well as the farm system. He said he's not quite sure when the rebuild will end, but he doesn't believe that point is too far away. He also reported that he had received a larger than usual amount of calls about his major league players, including several pitchers. He mentioned that he wouldn't give them away for a bargain, but he would be eager to finalize a deal if the offer was right. He also reported that he expects 2018's first overall draft pick, Casey Mize, to start the 2019 season in either high A or double A. The winter meetings are not just about trades. They're also a time for entrepreneurs to pitch their products to the teams. The annual baseball trade show was a multi-day event that allowed business owners to try and get their wares inside the baseball parks. One of the vendors, AMI, is a business from my hometown in New Hampshire that has been in sports stadiums, fields, and arenas for many years. They make high-quality signs for stadium walls and fencing, and are already in several major and minor league stadiums, but continue to attend the trade show to remain visible and current. The festivities were all but complete by Thursday when the Rule 5 draft took place. The event went at breakneck speed, with teams rattling off their selections every 10 seconds. Teams were able to select players not on others' franchises' 40-man rosters for a price of $100,000. The San Francisco Giants made two selections, while over a dozen teams made one, and many passed. However, the biggest news of the day was that Mariners general manager Jerry Tipoto, who fell ill earlier in the week, just finalized a trade from the hospital, getting Edwin Encarnacion in a massive three-team deal with the Indians and the Rays, which sent Jake Bowers and Carlos Santana to Cleveland and Yandy Diaz to Tampa Bay. The baseball winter meetings are always full of surprises, as well as famous people and exciting products, and were an absolute blast for me this year. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated Kids. We certainly hope that you have enjoyed it, and we hope you've enjoyed each of our past programs as well. We invite you to tune in every Thursday at 10 o'clock p.m. for the next episode and each succeeding episode. This program is rebroadcast, as noted, in the Triangle Radio Reading Service program guide, and is readily available as a podcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you happen to have any questions or comments about the program or our station, please call the Triangle Radio Reading Service at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. So long, until next time. Me kissing and hugging, so I shoved her away. I said, you better stop bugging. She got mad, looked me dead in my face, threw her hands in the air and yelled out, hey! I got scared when she started to yell, so I handed her my wallet and ran like hell. I was ducking through alleys, right and left, but when the cops caught up, they almost beat me to death. I was arrested, charged with aggravated assault, but it wasn't my fault. Well, nevertheless, don't mean to bust your bubble, but girls of the world ain't nothing but trouble. Gives you the play, just remember my rhymes and get the hell away. I was in a bar one Friday night, cooling, watching a Mike Tyson fight. I was mad.